जयमा. सो वी आर विद द मदर विद द कन्वर्सेशंस 1954 एंड शी वुड टिपिकली टेक अप अ बुक ऑफ श्योरबिंदो और हर ओन सम पैसेज फ्रॉम सम एसे एंड शी वुड रीड सम फ्रेंच ट्रांसलेशंस. सो इट वॉज ऑल्सो मेंट टू बी ए क्लास इन फ्रेंच इंसिडेंटली बिकॉज चिल्ड्रन वुड लर्न फ्रेंच एंड देन बेस्ड ऑन दैट चिल्ड्रन विल आस्क क्वेश्चंस. So we can imagine how she would sit whenever there is playground meditation. We can see there is a chair of the mother and we'll see a picture. And she would be sitting as the evening will fall. She's sitting with the table lamp. And it's so amazing that from 8 year to 80 year old, people sitting there and asking questions. The Divine Mother is there to answer their questions. And she herself is planting the questions, because when you look at the questions, it's not nobody would normally ask, and they are and all kinds of questions, like ask me anything, and she would very patiently listen. There would be humor, there would be sprinklings of delight, there would be downpourings of light, there would be awakening thunder flashes of God, then the fire springing up. It's a whole, if one were to capture that panorama, it's something very amazing. Sometimes she would ask, so what's the time? As the disciple would say, 9:20 p.m. Oh, okay, now I think we should stop. Do you have one more question? So the disciple asked question. So you see how long it used to go. Sometimes it would go on pretty late. And sometimes it would be very little based on the mode of the infinite, and that's how it is. So let's not this is the background, and we are with 1954, and she is preparing humanity for the great event which is going to happen after 2 years 2 months, 1956. So the beauty of these writings, as I keep saying, it doesn't matter whether you are a seeker, whether you are practicing their path or not their path. Any kind of humanity will, when you read through, you will benefit from it. They are some of those writings which are there to help us. So, for example, 27 January, there is a very interesting question someone has asked. And I was planning to skip it, but Mother, does a person's body formation express his character? Very interesting, because if you really look at it, there is a truth in it. So Sri Ramakrishna would sometimes see the body and then decide whether he is ready for yoga or not. Even the mother and Sri Aurobindo would see the picture, and through the picture they would enter into contact with the person. Some places Sri Aurobindo describes his forehead indicates that, but this part indicates something else. And the, so the mother says, so we have a tendency to draw general conclusions and apply something of very profound truth at our human level. So when to this question, the mother says, no, even the character itself is not a simple affair. Now this is very interesting. That is, the character of a person is not the expression of his true being, but the result of many things. We thought the other way around. We thought a person's character reflects the true being. Here it is the other way around. And there are so many examples in history. But it, you know. For example, atavism may be expressed, that is, what comes from the father, the mother, from both together, which may have a different result. From the antecedents, the past history, grandfathers, great-grandfathers, etc. And then from the environment in which people have lived when they were very young and had no independence at all. In Mother and Shubindo's case also, that heredity factor which came in. In Sri Aurobindo, it was his Nana, Raj, Rishi, Raj Narayan Bose. And he was very fond of him. It was to meet his Nana, that is mother's father, that he would travel all the way to Devghar. Via Madhupur, I'm sure. Because there is no other way you can go. So that's my birthplace. I used to feel so happy that there is no other way for Sri Aurobindo to go from Kolkata to Devghar unless you go via Madhupur. That's the only way. Route, road, train, whatever way you may take. Human mind finds its own way of taking joy. So he would go there, and he had a very closeness with his father, with his grandfather. And in the Divine Mother's case also, she had something from her grandmother, which is Nani, that's mother's mother. And the names were also same, Meera Ismaloon, so from whom she had taken in certain traits. She was a very bold and courageous lady. We cannot imagine mother's grandmother, and she would travel all the way from Egypt to Europe. And she would do business. Can we imagine those days? With all those perfumes and textiles, and she would carry and bring back. So there are things which come to us. And then of course the environment. That has a considerable effect on the character. And this character affects the physical formation. And this is so important because it has practical implication. At one point the mother says there are some parents who pass their shadows to the child. So what are shadows? That there are beautiful things which are there. In expressed in certain things, and there are things which have, we have held back inside. It can be understood even genetically. There are certain genes which express certain characteristics and others which are repressed, which may get expressed in another generation. So these shadows can be passed to a child, and she says unfortunately it's a gift they have given to the child, but it's not a very pleasant gift. All this happens unconsciously, to pass on the shadow. And this character affects the physical formation. So just by seeing somebody, one cannot quite say what his true nature is. One may describe his tendencies, know his difficulties, his possibilities, but it is only with the growth of the consciousness and as the development becomes voluntary and organized that the body can begin to express the true character of the person. So meaning thereby there is an impact on our inner growth on the physical body. And we see this in Sri Aurobindo's own life. When he comes here, he had those marks on the face, his complexion, all of it changed. And so much so that Purani ji asked, what has happened to you? And Sri Aurobindo asks in return, and what about you, sir? What has happened to you? So he passed away that, no, your hair seems so shining and your face and everything had changed. So there is an impact of our inner state on the body, and as we grow in consciousness, it can completely, it means that even on genes and heredity, it can completely override it. Because that's how in body's formation, genes have a role to play, a strong role to play. So this now we are beginning to recognize. And so she expresses many things and speaks about how the body is formed. Just to give a small little example. Naturally, the formation of the body is very important. In this sense that if, for instance, one is constantly under the influence of a depression, of pessimism, discouragement, a lack of faith and of trust in life, all this enters, so to say, into one's substance. And then some people, when there is the possibility of an accident, never miss it. So you see how she is explaining that it is literally one type of substance entering into the substance of the body. It's another kind of chemistry altogether, if you like. And for instance, the psychic, it has a sweetness. And this sweetness can literally enter into the body. Even the body odor can change. With Sri Aurobindo, all the time there was this lotus fragrance. Even after he physically withdrew, from the fluid that little bit came from the body, there was this fragrance of lotus, which people who carried him, they retained it right up to their departure. And I have met Somantrada, for example. He carried that fragrance. So there is a whole science, a whole chemistry, a whole world or worlds of which we are unaware. You have a whole field of observation here. Every time there is a chance of something happening to them, they catch it, be it an illness or an accident. Others do the same things, have as many chances of having an accident, but they are not touched. If you observe their character, you will see that the former have a tendency to pessimism and more or less expect something unpleasant to happen to them. And it happens, or else they are afraid. We know that fear always brings what one fears. If you fear an accident, this acts like a magnet drawing the accident towards you. In this sense, it may be said that it is the result of character, and the same thing holds for illness. So now you see the question naturally arises, okay, but then there are people who have all kinds of thoughts. There are people who the moment they step out, they think this may happen, that may happen. So what are we supposed to do? Is there a way? Is there a remedy? And this also she addresses. She addresses how we can handle these unpleasant thoughts. People pay a lot of money and go to a psychiatrist. And psychiatrist takes them to childhood traumas and opens a black box which he cannot handle after that. And years pass by. Childhood trauma, if you take the history, some kind of trauma people have. They are very common experiences, but they start pinpointing and they start moving around it. But see how simply the mother says, unpleasant thoughts. So the question is, mother, at times unpleasant thoughts come and disturb us. How can we get rid of them? So nice. She's not saying go to a psychiatrist and get treated. I'm here only to teach you about spiritual things. Everything is a spiritual thing. Everything can become a means of self-discovery. Everything can become, say, process of self-mastery. And that's what spirituality is about. It's self-discovery till you discover the highest. It's self-mastery till you master the lowest from the point of view of the highest. So everything in life, every small little thing. She says there are several methods. This is so very practical. And I can say this, vouchsafe for this. Of course, you don't need to vouchsafe for the mother. But as a psychiatrist, I haven't read anywhere something simpler and more practical and effective. Generally, but it depends on people, generally the easiest way is to think of something else. Turn your mind away. If you cannot, read something. Turn to something else, even watch a television. Go on to computer. I mean, it's not good to watch a television, but better than, you know, having unpleasant thoughts in the head. Read something, do an activity, engage in some activity. Something which will divert your mind. That is to concentrate one's attention upon something that has nothing to do with that thought, has no connection with that thought, like reading or some work. Generally something creative, some creative work. So for me, what used to work was reading, not unpleasant thought, but once, for example, Mother's Grace, that was never the case, but once I remember coming in a helicopter and the fuel had touched to a minimum. So there was a real threat that it finally landed with 5 minutes of fuel left. So we can imagine. So whatever be the reason, so obviously there was a lot of anxiety. So I had my own way of handling that anxiety. I had not turned to Mother and Sri Aurobindo. But I was reading Plato's Republic. So you know, I said, okay. You'll see that many people in the jail, when they are facing their last day, they are going to be hanged. They ask for reading some book. Imagine, it's not that they are suddenly want, they have turned philosopher and want to. It is a very good way to turn away your mind from an extreme situation which is going to take place. There it's inevitable. So when we read a book, your mind gets diverted. But of course, one should have the habit of reading. That's why she says it depends. Or some creative work. For instance, those who write, while they are writing, let us take simply a novelist. While he is writing, all other thoughts are gone, for he is concentrated on what he is doing. When he finishes writing, if he has no control, the other thoughts will return. So this is that, divert your mind. After some time, they have a tendency to return. Then the second thing she says, those who have begun to control their thoughts can make a movement of rejection. Push aside the thought as one would a physical object. She talks about it even in volume 3. We have read that in while Dhammapada commentaries. So one is that you divert your mind. Second is you reject certain thoughts. How do you reject? As if you are actually pushing a physical object. You can even give a concrete form. I don't want. And push it away. The only problem there is that sometimes people become obsessed with this. Almost like a game of ping pong. So they get into it. So there is a third thing she says. But that is more difficult and asks for a much greater mastery, if one can manage it. So the method she gave, which I have found, means suggesting to people, very rarely this kind of thing happens, but it's very powerful. The third means is to be able to bring down a sufficiently great light from above, which will be the denial in the deeper sense. That is, if the thought which comes is something dark, and especially if it comes from the subconscious or inconscient, and is sustained by instinct, if one can bring down from above the light of a true knowledge, a higher power, and put that light upon the thought, one can manage to dissolve it or enlighten or transform it. This is the supreme method. So in practice, actually we have this psychiatry and all these complicated procedures. So in an Indian village setting, whenever we are afraid, so what used to be told to us? We have grown up with this, ki you say, Bhut Pishach Nikat Nahi Aave, Mahavir Jab Naam Sunaave, take the name of God, or call Hanumanji. So what was that? That you had a faith that if I am taking the name of Hanumanji, nobody will ever come. Now, leaving aside the question whether Hanumanji actually came or didn't come, but this is the denial. What is the denial? In the presence of Hanuman, no power can come. And this was so beautifully inbuilt in our fabric. With the stories of Hanuman, every household had read it. So something in our context, for example, what I advise is that, imagine a light which is coming and smashing that formation. Fear, all this. Or simply, mother is here. Call the mother. Chant the mother's name. So when we do it, it denies, because death cannot be where there is the divine mother. There can be only a transition from one form of life to another. So this idea, another way which used to be there in Indian setting was reading the Gita, or chanting of the Gita. So these were means by which when we are afraid, of course we should do it, certain sensitivity is required in these matters. So if you start praying the Gita in the room of a sick person, he thinks my time is over. That's why I know someone who said, "Bhaiya, Gita kyun padh rahe ho? Why are you reading the Gita? Has the doctors written me off?" So, well, this is a modern problem, because we think doctors will do miracles. See, this is unfortunately a kind of, we have empowered, just like we empowered death, we empowered illness, we have empowered doctors, that they are the ones who are going to, we have empowered medicines. So not that they don't have an effect or don't have a place. In the totality of things, they have a place. But God is God. There is no comparison. Doctor can be an instrument if he is really open. Medicines can be an instrument. But equally, it may work the other way around. So this used to be that, play the Gita. And also it's so beautiful to spend your thoughts on that. Sometimes we give exercises. Those who don't believe, play some music or talk to them about, imagine what you would like to construct in your future. So these are ways that the unpleasant thoughts, disturbing thoughts, thoughts of an illness. One classic example is when a person had rheumatoid arthritis, noted in one of the books of Norman Cousins, Anatomy of an Illness. So he was written off. This is in 40s. Even now we don't have anything like a cure. Anyways, allopathy has very little cures, but it can contain the symptom, which is fair enough. So that time there were hardly any, your joints get stiff and all this. So this fellow one day ran away from the hospital. And people didn't know what an illness is due to. So if you run away from the hospital, it is an offense. So he ran away from the hospital. He shut himself in a hotel room and he started watching all kinds of things. So television had just come that time. He started watching certain things. Hilarious things. If I remember right, it was those Charlie Chaplin, some of the first those non-speaking silent movies had come. And he was so completely fine within 6 months. Another example where a person would play music and suddenly when he was playing the piano, all his stiffness would disappear. So the mind has a great role to play. And if we can turn it away, the mind unfortunately has become a factory for unpleasant things. One way to avoid all this is don't watch on television and newspaper all kinds of, horror things which are happening all the time. Because then we are already feeding this factory which is turned towards it, darkness. Then there is, of course, depression. So this is again very simple, very beautifully she explains depression. It's so simple that anybody who reads it will say, yes, but of course. So what is it? Why do we get depressed? And how can depression be controlled? Mother says, oh, there's a very simple way. What's the simple way? Depression occurs generally in the vital. And one is overpowered by depression only when one keeps the consciousness in the vital. When one remains there, the only thing to do is to get out of the vital and enter a deeper consciousness. So basically it's shifting the needle. It's like if you are caught in a storm, come out of that. Mother gives an example in Huta's, I think Mother, you said so. She says, there is a door. You enter the door and shut it. Then you are safe from the storm. Sometimes one would see such things in vision that huge ocean is splashing and one is protected inside a glass case and it's the waves are splashing and you are safe. That's like you are safe from the world forces. Sea rising up indicates that. You are safe inside. So she says, but people have the key but they don't care to open. So this is the other problem. We have never learned to shift this needle of consciousness. And that's why it happens that sometimes friends, window shopping, all these, vital to vital also it helps. Suddenly you go, in vital also there are domains. Lower vital and higher vital. You shift it and you see, or somebody who has got emotional sympathy with you and you feel good. Some doctors can make you feel worse. And people used to complain to Sri Aurobindo and about Nirodha, and one day he tells him, consider me as somebody who is hard and all these things. Particularly when women come, they think about me like this. He says, better than thinking that you are soft like a trinkle. And it's a very interesting comment of Sri Aurobindo. But he says, how should a doctor be? He says, jolly as jam and something like butter and always full of humor. So basically all these things come as waves. When we enter into another zone, maybe in the atmosphere of a person who is happy and jolly, you will see that it melts away. Then you try to think. You think of the incident, but you are not able to get depressed unless you ultimately retire into your room and you are alone. You like to wear sackcloths because, that's the tradition. You are supposed to wear sackcloths out of habit. You are supposed to be depressed if something has been taken away from you. These are nothing but habits of nature, inbuilt, that if something is taken away from you, you better be depressed. Because everybody is depressed. The same story of Lulu, Lulu, Lulu. And finally he says, I don't know what is Lulu, but I think she is desirable. But everybody is asking for her. So I am thinking that I don't have Lulu, so I am also unhappy. He doesn't even know who she is. So this is how the story goes. And if he shifted even into the higher mind. See, that's why many of these things, reading the Gita, doing japa, turning to these things, even turning to read a beautiful book, or in the company of somebody who is, full of good humor. But unfortunately, we meet, we have friends also, with whom we'll say, this happened to you. Oh, what a tragedy has struck you. I mean, they compound the depression, multiply it. And so instead of that, be in the company of somebody who can just tell you, it's okay, life, take it in your stride. Though if a doctor says this, they think you are insensitive. So, lot of complications in human life. If you tell them that, what is there to be depressed about? So they say, you don't even understand or care about me. So human mind's complexities. But nevertheless, the only thing to do is to get rid of the vital, get out of the vital and enter a deeper consciousness. Even the higher mind, the luminous higher mind, which is the birthplace of religions. That's why a lot of people see psychiatrists a modern invention, because when people stopped believing in God, they went to doctors and psychiatrists. But otherwise, where did a typical Indian go? He went to the priest, he went to the temple, and he felt relief. I know so many people who we never knew all these depressions, suicides, and whatever. It was so rare. Even when one reaches just the highest domains of thought, usually the depression disappears. For us, the simplest way is read Savitri. It acts like magic. Open any page, just read a few lines, it's magic. It just vanishes. God knows what happens. It just, You don't know what it did. It's magic. But in any case, if one seeks shelter in the psychic, then there is no longer any room for depression. So she has given us so many ways. Shift the needle of consciousness. Don't live in the vital. Don't be with people that will put you stuck in the vital, who will lament at you and they will, you know, oh, what a bad thing has happened to you. Oh, that fellow, put anger, put all kinds of things. Instead of that, be in the company of those who at least have a little more thoughtful, little more philosophical, a little higher mind. So that's where we should be. Depression may come from two causes, either from a want of vital satisfaction or from a considerable nervous fatigue in the body. This is what is important to remember. So, vital satisfaction, invariably, some desire which has not been fulfilled. And if one looks at it, it's 100% correct. Most of the time, why does the vital starts crying, complaining? Because some desire has been unfulfilled. It may be a desire for somebody recognizing you. It may be such a trivial thing that you did a good work and in your eyes, because in our eye everybody does a good work, and somebody you were expecting to appreciate you, that person did not appreciate. Whose appreciation you were looking for? In the ashram, this is a way of life, because you are supposed to do yoga. Not only that, one step further, you may just be criticized for something which you have actually overlooked. But that's what yoga is about. It's a yog nagri, not a bhog nagri. So, you know, so that's how. So it comes from. But very importantly, another cause which is often missed is depression arising from considerable nervous fatigue in the body. Depression arising from physical fatigue is set right fairly easily. One has but to take rest. This is so true. When you are constantly on the go, then the nerves get frail. And these nerves become extremely sensitive. Even they become, sometimes we'll observe that people become very snappy when, you know, just because they're tired. So it's good to just teach them to take rest. So they need rest. The want of vital, one goes to bed and sleeps, one feels well again, or else one rests, dreams, lies down. The want of vital satisfaction comes up rather easily, and usually one must face it with one's reason, must ferret out the cause of the depression, what has brought about the lack of satisfaction in the vital. So the mind can take several positions, and one of the most best positions philosophically is, such is the nature of life, such is the nature of world, such is the nature of humanity, it is imperfect. So you, if you are expecting that people would be perfect, they would be nice, kind, courteous, mother at one place in this very volume. Somebody says, but you know, even when you have not done anything bad, why are people like this? He says, well, that's why, because people's assessment and evaluation is like that. If you have done something good, people tend to forget it. But if you have done something which, even sometimes you have done good to people, and there is a whole psychology behind it, which the mother at one point explains. Why do people to whom you have done good, they can pay you in very harsh coins? And the reason is because it burdens them. You know, that somebody is doing all the good. So how can they just, you know, take care of their own burden by criticizing the person? Oh, he's no good. He's not done anything special to me. So this is their way of releasing that burden that they are feeling, a burden of guilt, because they are on the receiving end. So all these psychological aspects she reveals, we have to look, and then one looks at it straight in the face and asks oneself whether that indeed has anything to do with one's inner aspiration, or whether it is simply quite an ordinary movement. So ultimate remedy for those who are into yoga, how is this person's comment or lack of comment or whatever it be, not fulfilling my expectations, how is it helping me in terms of the yoga, my aspiration? And then you see that everything can feed your aspiration in a beautiful way. Rather than, and there is a very beautiful prayer of the mother, very touching. Suddenly before thee my pride fell. And she says, it is idle to seek anywhere else than in thee. She addresses the divine as friend, confidant. So when we take that, and the sooner we take that route, the better it is. Otherwise, expectations and unhappiness and this and that, it's a vicious cycle. We only keep changing outer forms, but consciousness, human beings are limited. So we have to understand that. Generally, one discovered that it has nothing to do with the inner aspiration, and one can quite easily overcome it and resume one's normal movement. If that is not enough, one must go deeper and deeper until one touches the psychic reality. Sometimes it can even come as a very causeless kind of thing. Apparently, that's because the inconscient has opened up. And that is sending all kinds of, it's like literally a nameless fear. Some people are gripped by a nameless fear, it's apparently causeless depression. That is because of the hostile forces which really attack. They create chaos, confusion. That's rare, but it can happen. There the remedy is to try to find the psychic. Naturally, if one has never done it, never tried it, it's impossible to suddenly, it can happen as a result of a special grace. But that's why it is said that jo dukh mein sumiran sab kare, sukh mein kare na koi. Jo sukh mein sumiran kare, to dukh kahe koi. People wait for unhappiness to remember the name of God. But if they learn to remember the name of God, when they are happy, then why would unhappiness strike you? Now, this doesn't mean events won't happen. Events will happen. That's the nature of life. But you will be remain untouched. So that's what the mother is reminding us. As for fighting in the vital domain itself, well, some people are good fighters and love to struggle with their vital. But to tell you the truth, that is much more difficult. Some people can fight it off. So such beautiful, simple ways and very effective ways. Problem is we don't like to, sometimes when something is too simple, but it requires a sincerity. That's where the difficulty lies. Because if I have to look inside and say, oh, I am suffering from a want of satisfaction, it requires you to be sincere. It's much easier to say, because of that person I am suffering. It passes the burden. But not realizing that while it passes the burden, you lose your freedom. Because now it's not in your control. Because it has to be other person should change. Which in all likelihood will never happen. I mean, he has his own journey. Even if the person changes, the person will not change according to you. Nobody is designed and it should never be done. I keep telling it even as a psychiatrist. People come and say, I tried to change myself according to the other person. I said, please don't do it. Swadharmo nidhanam shreya paradharmo bhyava. You are not meant, none of us is meant to change ourselves to please another person. You can't do that. You try doing it, it won't work. You have to grow along the lines that nature has designed you to and God is calling you. Another person will grow along those lines. And then we understand the deeper meaning of let there be spaces in your togetherness. Otherwise there will be a problem. Nobody can change to suit another person. Then about fear, somebody asks, so see, we covering one after another. So she says, what is fear? So fear is, see, of course it comes from the inconscient, the worst kind of impurity. You see, what fear is, what the fear from the inconscient is, I can put it in a with an image, but a real image. Go to a tower, really high, and then you look down. Now, you're not falling, but just this sight can be very frightening. Nothing is happening to you, but you look down, it's frightening. So this fear is not fear of heights. People put it wrongly. It's a fear of abyss. You go into that and you don't know. So this fear, why? Because you don't know what's there. And the what comes from the abyss, which really makes us full of fear, is unconsciousness. That's why this idea, see the divine everywhere, is the perfect safety. If we really practice it, then even in darkest states, we can see the divine. But basically it comes from, she says, unconsciousness. It is a kind of anguish that comes from ignorance. One does not know the nature of a certain thing, does not know its effect or what will happen, does not know the consequences of one's acts. One does not know so many things, and the ignorance brings fear. One fears what one does not know. So what is the antidote? Knowledge. Often this ignorance, half knowledge. I may die, confront it. What is death? That's why see in the Gita in the beginning itself, second chapter, Sri Krishna removes the fear of death. First thing he does is, he says either which way, if you take that there is an immortal soul, there is nothing to fear because you never die. If you take it, there is no such thing which abides and the body is you and it dies. So there is nothing to fear again because this is the destiny everybody is going to pass through one day or the other. So by trying to understand, looking at things with the eye of knowledge, and the deeper and higher the knowledge, the easier it is. So, and often fear completely distorts not only a perception but our action. The other day I was putting it across to someone. I said, see, it's like how fear can completely either paralyze you or it can make you go berserk. So imagine someone comes and says in your garden, no, I have seen a snake. Now, one extreme reaction will be you will not go to the garden because you are totally afraid now. Where will the, you will see snake everywhere. The other is that you will say, bhaiya, find the snake. And the person is digging, ultimately your whole garden is gone. Digging for the snake. These are the two extreme reactions. But what is the correct way? First find out what snake, who saw, what kind, most of the snakes may be non-poisonous. So probably he's a rat snake. He will eat the rats. He is going to, you know, that's how it used to be in my village. There used to be a lot of rat snakes. And there were all kinds of stories and we used to see the also. But never invoked because we all had this idea, this is a good snake. But big, long snake. It's a long snake. But it's not poisonous. So it doesn't, you know, hurt you in any way. So when you understand the nature of a thing, you are no more afraid. The second is, okay, try to understand if a snake has come, why it has come. Why? Because probably there is a plant which attracts snakes. Now, this is another kind of knowledge. So, you need to tackle it at that level and not like the entire garden you are digging up. So, when we do that way, when we, knowledge is empowerment. That's why it is said, Ya Vidya Vimuktaye, knowledge liberates us. Any kind of knowledge. And ultimately, fear of abyss, what is there? Divine is everywhere. So this is the ultimate power of liberation. So she says that basically we must, that which knows has no fear. That which is perfectly awake, which is fully conscious and which knows has no fear. It is always something dark that is afraid. One of the great remedies for conquering fear is to face boldly what one fears. So people often say, this may happen. Oh, I may lose the money, or the money that I have given may never come back. Okay, fine. It will not come back. What's going to happen now? So when you look at it that way, one day you face it and say, okay, that's fine. It won't come back. But I am still alive. I have my aspiration, like that Siddharth. Harman said, what can you do? He said, I can think, I can eat, I can meditate. So, when you see that there are things which your core, nobody can take away from you. Even if everything is taken away. So, this knowledge, just looking at, facing things boldly, not afraid. What is death really at the end of the day? So, she says that you are put face to face with the danger you fear and you fear it no longer. The fear disappears. From the yogic point of view, the point of view of discipline, this is the cure recommended. So we know how Swami Vivekananda turned back once when a monkey was trying to, and just looked at the monkey. He was initially trying to run and then he looked back and then the monkey retreated. So this is the yogic point of view, and she describes how in Egypt people were to lie in a sarcophagus for 3 days or a few days. And they were just provided food and air. So that fear of death goes away. You can't learn occultism with fear. So that's how they practiced occultism. Many of these aghori sadhus And in India, the way is Tatona Vijugupsate. You can't have the divine if you are shrinking from anything. So if you are afraid, you shrink. And if you shrink, then there is, you cannot realize that state of oneness. The reverse is also true. The more you grow in oneness with the divine, fear vanishes. So, when fear comes, if one succeeds in putting upon it consciousness, knowledge, force, light, one can cure it altogether. Then, of course, he speaks about all kinds of adverse forces and their working. And then she says something very interesting. This fear may also come from an antipathy. That is a lack of affinity with something. Now this is something very interesting. If you go to a new place, you don't need to go to a new country, you go to a new state where people speak a different language, they look different. And you feel afraid. Why? Simply because it's something new and you don't know them. So when we were children, I still remember seeing an African, a Negro. Parents would say, Habshi hai. What is Habshi? He will eat you alive. Man eating. Yeah, it's racist, agreed. But they were, tall, huge built. And it evoked that sense of, fear. So they used to stay away. When I went to Africa, of course, all that had gone away much earlier. Some of the most beautiful people. You feel so deeply connected. You feel you are much closer to them than the, they are so much with the ground. They have a religion which is so close to, our own ancient Sanatana Dharma. Of course, they didn't have the sense of oneness. But so much is the contact with the spirit of nature, kind, generous, emotional, that, it's so amazing. But initially, when you don't know, just the different appearance makes you feel, oh, this is something to be afraid of. So it's like when we are not in affinity with something, we tend to be afraid. So affinity is one has to conquer. You cannot deal with, talk about yoga if you are, still talking of affinities and things like that. And then so many things he says that, for example, can the hour of death, is it fixed or not fixed? Very interesting. She says, just one sentence I'll read. This is exactly what I have just explained. It is a very few who are capable of bringing down another determinism into the physical determinism. These can change the hour of death. So, if you are open to the divine, open to higher realms, or you have even a very strong idea from the higher worlds of spiritual mind, or the psychic touch, you can change it. But otherwise, ordinarily, it is something fixed. That's what she says. That's what we see in Savitri also. Okay. Controversial subjects. Meat eating. Mother gives a very interesting idea about meat. She's not touching it from moral standpoint. She says something very interesting. And puts everything in its right place. That is to say, in a greater or lesser proportion, you swallow along with the meat a little of the consciousness of the animal you eat. Which is so logical, so scientific. And then she says, it is not very serious, but it is not always very pleasant. So, if you have eaten chicken and these chicken have been slaughtered in a way without, so that thing can come inside. Or of course, that's why higher animals, it was told not to eat. Because they have rush of emotions, rage, anger, fear, all these are moving in the blood. And then when you eat it, it's not a very good thing. And that's why you see, now there's so much controversy about jhatka and halal. So what is jhatka? Jhatka you kill right away. And halal is you do it in a very torturous way. You cut half the gardan, neck, and so in Islam you are supposed to eat halal. In Sikhism you can eat jhatka. So which is logically more correct? See what happens when you are doing halal. Actually, you are letting a lot of pain and anguish because the creature has not died. It's in great pain and agony, and all this is rushing into the blood and entering the muscles. I don't know why it is advised. It is so illogical. But well, blindness is blindness. And so when you eat a halal meat, it is not good because leave aside religion, because the animal has gone through a lot of pain and anguish. But what is jhatka? Do it straight away. So animal just, there is a nervous thing and then it settles down. Not that it's like asking what is choose between the devil and the deep sea. But if at all. So it's very interesting because in Sikhism, which is more rooted in Sanatana Dharma and its occult mystic traditions, it is said that you can eat meat, but of course, ideal is to be a vegetarian. But if you eat, because they are martial races, so if you eat meat, eat jhatka. So Sardar is not supposed to eat halal meat. But in Muslims, strangely, it is the halal meat. As if that rage that goes into the animal. Because see, it's in anguish. So in anguish, what does an animal do? It is trying all kinds of things. So that aggression, that rage, that anguish, also the fear. And you will see paradoxically in certain races. Sorry, not being racist. I am not taking any names. Who indulge in halal meat, you will see both anger and fear together. Extreme degree of anger, extreme degree of fear. Just like an animal. I am not promoting either. Okay. So she says, and obviously it does not help you in being on the side of man rather than of the beast. It is evident that primitive men, those who were still much closer to the beast than to the spirit, apparently used to eat raw meat, and that gives much more strength than cooked meat. So that's how she speaks about evolving. But if one wishes to pass from this ordinary life to higher one, the problem begins to become interesting. So then she speaks about, and particularly if you want to go for physical transformation. So you shouldn't make absolute dogmatic rules for anyone and everyone. That's not a right thing. And also because of certain regions in which people have grown, they've developed certain habits. And it drops off as the consciousness becomes more and more subtle. But the principle is interesting. It's the consciousness you absorb. So what about plants? If you see in plant, there is just that layer of consciousness which is life-giving to matter. So it is very light. When you eat fruits, fruits are just that living vital or the vital which animates the physical and gives it life. It doesn't have that kind of strong emotions and fear and rage. And especially when it is ripe and ready. So what you are taking, absorbing, just the life vital force which gives life to matter. So it's easy, light. So she explains it so logically. It's not about, and then she leaves you free. She says it's not a serious matter, but it becomes serious if you are engaging in certain types of yoga. So then, of course, see, lot of things. Let me see if, very interesting one place I read about religious beings. All the puja ceremonies and elaborate. So we know that story when somebody came from Bengal and wanted to worship Mother and Shurubindo as Durga and Shiva. So Shurubindo said okay when they asked. Respecting, they always would respect the traditions, people, and then take them from near to the far. So people often misunderstood that the mother was giving sanction to this or that. She was not giving sanctions. She was taking people from where they are, holding their hand. That's why you see certain pujas, not puja, but she would come and remind that, okay, Durga is also in her, see Kali in her, see Saraswati in her. But now people have discovered their own ways. So on every time there is Durga puja, Saraswati puja, we will see all the traditional forms of Chaturbhuja Devi and all this circulating on Sri Aurobindo WhatsApp. That's not what she is saying. When she would sit and give darshan, it means now you see them as aspects of the one divine mother. That is the message she is conveying. She is not conveying, go back to the typical Durga puja and Kali puja. There is nothing wrong in those who want to do it. But she is lifting the gods and our consciousness in relation with the gods one step higher. And also, even in Tantra it is said there are three kinds of puja. Bahya puja, which is more for the animal humanity, Pashuvat. So Pashupati. Then there is a more of the hero, Virshaiva path. Here you struggle with the forces of nature within. The demons are within, the gods are within. And then there is the Dev-like, the Manas puja, where you are doing it all in the mind. It's known in our tradition. So sometimes when people say, why is mother saying this? So you read your own tradition, it is there. It's not something new. All mystics have said, Guru Vishnu, Guru Brahma, Guru Deva Maheshwara, Guru Sakshat Parabrahma, Tasmai Shri Guruvai Nama. In the master you have to see all the gods, greatest gods. And you have to see even Parabrahman. So she says, but if you take real divine being, this is a long passage on page 195. This is not at all something they value. They do not like to be worshipped. No, it does not give them any special pleasure at all. Imagine even if you are a good human being. Somebody comes and you know gives you some money and this thing. But he is leading a life which is completely opposite to what you stand for. How would you feel? You'll feel very happy because somebody is, you know, doing all the... And that too, sometimes such loud music. And you take a coconut and break it. I mean, by all means, please do it if you want to. But break this coconut. This is so much more difficult. Offer the flowers of faith inwardly. Light up the fragrance of aspiration. That's how the mother says. While those who want to do it, they should do it. Don't discourage or because everybody is not in the same stage. But she says you will not get the real divine being. You will get beings of the vital world who will give you some desires. Real divine beings will run away. Don't think they are happy, for they have no pride. It is because of pride that a man likes to be worshipped. If a man has no pride, he doesn't like to be worshipped. And if, for instance, they see a good intention or a fine feeling or a movement of unselfishness or enthusiasm, a joy, a spiritual joy, these things have for them an infinitely greater value than prayers and acts of worships and puja. So true. Would Durga like next to her pandal, you have Mahisasur having a gala day with Bollywood songs and Golgappa parties? Would real Durga, would we do that also? I mean, it's something we need to contemplate. So thank God these divine beings stay away from. But we continue. I mean, this is such a profound knowledge. And if we look at it, all this has come when India was in the decline. This is all gifts of Kali Yuga. Where do you read all this in the Vedas, Upanishads, the Gita? These are in India of decline, dharma siklani. So you have to bring it back to its original truth. Again, the mother says, those who want to continue can continue. It's their business. Nobody's business to stop anyone. But one must understand the principle behind things. I assure you, what I am telling you is very serious. So next year when the lady wanted to do it again, suddenly mother said, do you think that a divine being likes all this? Durga will actually like all this? Then she retreated. This was her way of explaining to her. So she says, I assure you what I am telling you is very serious. If you seat a real god in a chair and oblige him to remain there all the while you are doing puja, he may perhaps have a little fun watching you do it, but it certainly gives him no satisfaction. None at all. He does not feel either flattered or happy or glorified by your puja. You must get rid of that idea. And frankly, if a god gets satisfied the human way, then perhaps he's not a god. But anything else. Because gods are above pride, above they act in a luminous, self-evident light. They can't be swayed because you have done so many pujas. Then what kind of a god it'll be? Gods act according to the light of the divine. They receive the command, the great gods. And then she says, there is an entire domain between the spiritual and the material worlds which belongs to vital beings. And it is this domain that is full of all these things. Because these things live upon that, are happy with it, and it immediately gives them importance. I am speaking of the true gods, even those of the overmind, though they are still a bit, well, so-so. They seem to have taken on many human defects, but still, despite all that, they really have a higher consciousness. It does not please them at all. So what pleases the divine? See, we have those four aspects of the Divine Mother. Where Shrivinda says, what is pleasing to the gods? What is pleasing? An act of true goodness. You can't fool them. Intelligence. Unselfishness. Or a subtle understanding. Or a very sincere aspiration. Are for them infinitely higher than a small religious ceremony. And it's so logical. Why would somebody who lives in truth be taken away by show and sham? Of course, there are very few people who can put their heart and soul into that ceremony. That mother explains elsewhere. But that is very rare. Very rare. And most of the places where these kind of events are taking place, the true gods hardly come. And if you can put that heart and soul into a ceremony or a puja, you can do it anywhere. The divine being will manifest. So this is what she expresses. Of course, people understand it in their own way. Just two more little things I'll read very quickly. One where she speaks about the domain of death. She describes that as when we leave the body, we go into a world which is just beyond the physical, and there are several kinds, it's jostling with all kinds of beings. Generally adverse entities, formations, the lower vital that is thrown. That's what you feel in graveyards and these places. Because after death, these things, so one is projected into that domain. So all these gory pictures that we see, that is what is called as domain of death. But it's a domain from which people pass. And then they go into the vital and mental, to the psychic world. All that we have already discussed. But something Mother says, which is very interesting, in a very self-effacing way, she says, when she explains about death, the domain of death. She says, this of course is the general law, going through all this material, vital. Now there are bridges, as it were, protected passages, which have been built in the vital world in order to cross over all these dangers. There are atmospheres which receive people leaving their body, give them shelter, give them protection. She herself has built a passage. She talks about it in Algeria. So she explains what we should do. There are all kinds of other conditions which I have told you just now is the normal state of things. The general law remains unless there is a special higher development. There are people with so total a cohesion in their being that they no longer depend upon the body. And then she finally says that, but if you aspire, if you send them love, then these beings get sheltered. So if there is the thought of love reaching out to those who have departed, they are surrounded in a kind of protective layer when they are passing through this most material vital. Then she speaks about nervousness, and nervousness is, and then she speaks about love, and there we will stop. Something very interesting. Two topics interest everybody: death and love. You write a book on death, it will sell. You write a book on love, even if it's nonsense, it will sell. So naturally, because these are the two original primal forces. Death, which divides, pulls everything to the abyss, and love, which unites and carries ultimately everything to the divine. That's why these two things have the greatest attraction. But then do we really understand love? So somebody has asked a question. It's a long passage. I'm just reading a couple of lines. Before our nature is transformed, can a person love another truly? Mother says, love another? I have said that there, that it is impossible. I have said that if one wants to know what love is, one must love the divine. Then there is a chance of knowing what love is. Then you know what love is because you have tasted it. And then when you love someone, you can, something of that love will pass very naturally. Now you know the original. Then she gives very nice example which I want to read. So somebody asked, in order to know how to love truly, should the nature be transformed? Mother gives a very beautiful general answer. The quality of the love is in proportion to the transformation of your consciousness. So the disciple says, I don't understand. Child says, I don't understand. Mother says, it is childishly simple. If you have the consciousness of an animal, you will love like an animal. Ravana also loves Sita. But how does he love? See, I have got this for you. I have got gold. I have got this. I am such a big man. That's all he can conceive. What can Rama give you? He says, well, you don't understand what love is. You're talking of love. So, you will love like an animal. If you have the consciousness of an animal, you will love like an animal. If you have the consciousness of an ordinary man, you will love like an ordinary man. If you have the consciousness of an elite being, you will love like an elite being. And if you have a God's consciousness, you will love like a God. It is simple. So clear, without any ambiguity. So, instead of seeing outer things and what money somebody has and what one can give you, feel the consciousness. And it can only come if you are sitting quietly with a person. You can feel it. It's not something very difficult. And we can even develop this sensitivity. Provided, of course, I mean, a lot of things when we grow up in tradition were meant to help you feel that sensitivity. And if you feel that, you will know that whether it's something truly genuine or not. And then she says, gives an example with which we'll stop. You take the purest water. Water from the crystalline rocks. You collect it in a fairly large vase. And then in this vase, there is a little mud or much or a huge quantity of mud. And you could not say it is the same water which came down. Yet it is the same. Only you have mixed it with so many things in your vase that it no longer resembles it at all. Well, love in its essence is an absolutely pure, crystalline, perfect thing. In the human consciousness, it gets mixed with a fairly considerable amount of mud. And what is worse is, it becomes a very brittle and a small vessel. If the vessel is small, what happens? It loses its force. Imagine that same water, which is coming from the original source. It's coming from Shiva's head, for example. The same Ganges. And you put it in a small little vase. It's okay, it is Ganga Pani. But the force, that torrent which can drown you, that is missing. If it is muddy, it becomes dirty. And if the vase is brittle, it will break. So that's why it is said, it is only the wide and strong who can bear love. One has to be very wide and very strong to be able to bear the flame of love or the downpourings of love. Okay, so we'll pause here. Jai Ma. We'll continue.